So good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Global Taiwan Institute. GTI is a 501c3 nonprofit policy incubator dedicated to insightful, cutting-edge, and inclusive research on policy issues regarding Taiwan and the world. GTI hosts bi-monthly panels on a wide variety of relevant issues, from security and defense to human rights. This year, we were very lucky to have collaborated with the Taiwan Foundation for Democracy to bring a series of democracy and civil society events to DC, of which this is the last. We also produce a biweekly policy brief, so I encourage you to sign up for that at www.globaltaiwan.org. I just realized I left off a perhaps important part, which is, hi, I'm Anna Scott Bell. So yes, welcome. I work here at GTI. So also, just to start, I want to take a minute to recognize a couple of folks in the audience. We have a couple of our advisors here, including Dr. David Tsai, right here, and Garrett Vanderbeef over there. And we actually have one of our advisors has come especially far and is graciously serving on today's panel, Dr. Fang Wengshu, right here, having come all the way from London. So I also want to thank my colleagues, Director Russell Shao, and Senior Research Fellow David Ahn, Program Associate Jonathan Lin, Office Director Lily Lin, and our intern, intrepid intern of the fall semester, Stephanie Adams. And speaking of interns, we are looking for interns for next semester, so please send people our way if you know anyone, or apply yourself. Thank you. So today's panel covers an issue close to my heart, religion and democracy. While many long hypothesized that religion would die out with the rise and spread of liberal technocratic democracies, assuming the two were incompatible, many areas of the world have actually experienced significant religious resurgences alongside democratic transition. However, this has not always happened peacefully, and politically engaged religious groups do not always coexist well in the same political arenas. Taiwan is unique in Asia and in the world as it maintains a vibrant, pluralistic religious culture which both agitates and stabilizes its famously robust democracy. In my own research, I have found that much about the contemporary relationship between religious groups and the state have as much to do with historical factors as they do theological ones. Most significantly, how did religion engage the state under martial law and authoritarianism? So today, I want to look backward at this complicated history, but also forward at how religious groups engage and shape the democratic process today. To do this, we have four excellent panelists. Mike Fonte, perhaps better known for his role as director of the DPP's mission in Washington, also served in the late 1960s as a Catholic missionary in central Taiwan. He has worked in various capacities since to advance Taiwan's democracy and interests. Dr. Fang Wengshu specializes in the anthropology of Chinese religions with a focus on issues of the family, gender, nationalism, and democracy. Dr. Shu has been research fellow at the Asia Research Center at the London School of Economics and Political Science and has served as co-director of LSE's Taiwan Research Program since 2009. As I mentioned, she also serves on the advisory board of the Global Taiwan Institute. Dr. Wenshan Chen is a feminist activist, a lay contextual theologian, and an assistant professor of religious studies at Yushan Seminary. Her publications cover areas such as applied ethics, gender studies, disability studies, the abolition of the death penalty, restorative justice, and human rights. Finally, Dr. Zhu Fengcheng received her PhD from the Catholic University of America, where she completed a doctoral dissertation on the Presbyterian Church in Taiwan, looking at Han Chinese converts from traditional Chinese religions. She is an adjunct professor at Nazarene Bible College alongside her work in the NGO sector. So as you can see, we have a diverse panel of both practitioners and experts, and have some a great opportunity today to really get into this issue. So if my first question is for Mike Fonte. So Mike, you have the unique experience of having lived in Taiwan as a Mary Knoll missionary under martial law, but also after leaving the order and returning to the United States, fighting for democracy alongside Taiwanese exiles and activists. You now serve as director of the DPP's office in the United States. Having studied and served as a religious, you are a well-informed participant observer of religious dynamics in Taiwan. But working in Taiwan politics, you also understand the intricacies of Taiwan's democratic transition and contemporary political challenges. Can you give us a brief sketch of how you saw religion and religious groups participating in Taiwan's resistance and democracy movements before martial law was lifted?
Thanks, Anna. Thanks very much to GTI for the invitation. We do a great set of panels here, and I'm happy to be a participant. Context is everything when you're trying to understand and unwind political developments. When I lived in Taiwan 1967 to 70, for those of you who are too young to remember or know, the Vietnam War was raging, and U.S. policymakers used the war, used the so-called domino effect as a rationale for the murder and mayhem that we were imposing, unfortunately, on Vietnam and the Vietnamese people. If Vietnam goes communist, so the argument went by the U.S.'s best and brightest, the dominoes throughout Southeast Asia would fall. And Taiwan, therefore, supported this U.S. war effort with U.S. planes and ships using Taiwan as a base, with U.S. soldiers coming to Taiwan for R&R. And this fit well with Chiang Kai-shek regime, the KMT regime, being a front wedge against communism. This was a theme that was promoted largely by the Chinese, by China lobby / Taiwan lobby in the United States. Richard Nixon, of course, was one of the hardest anti-communists ever, and yet he was also a political idealist, political pragmatist, I should say. And when he was elected, he said that he would solve the Vietnam problem. He was going to create a peace in Vietnam. And by promising to do that, he looked at a wide picture and chose to play the China card, right? He decided he was going to get the Chinese to help him by blocking the flow of goods and materials that were coming from the Soviet Union through China to Vietnam to support the northern Vietnamese as they were fighting in that war. And he wanted to crimp those supplies, and he also later wanted, of course, to use China as a card against the Soviet Union. So Nixon changed his anti-communist stripes. In fact, it's better to say he altered them a bit, right? He kept his anti-communist stripes against the Soviet Union, but gave China a pass, right? Chiang Kai-shek did not give China a pass, right? He continued his strong, but violent almost, anti-communism. And his U.S. enablers never made this turn. There was a man named Walter Judd, who had been a missionary in China. He was very ferocious in the Congress for a long time and also later as a lobbyist, the so-called head of the China lobby. When he, in conjunction with the Life magazine people, Henry and Claire Booth Luce, trumpeted Chiang Kai-shek and his wife Song Mei-lin as good Christians standing against the tide of communism. So this was a context for what was happening during martial law times. That is that Chiang Kai-shek, the KMT regime, was seen as strong bulwark against communism and was supported then during this period. So there was a maldun, there was a contradiction, if you will, between the fact that the U.S. had made a turn on its relationship with China but kept its relationship with Chiang Kai-shek. And this created a lot of tensions in Taiwan, as you could guess. So to protect the institutions and be allowed to continue to work in Taiwan, most religious groups kept their heads down and restricted their religious practices to inside the walls of the church or the temples. They didn't want to get caught up in being cast as anti-KMT and therefore must be communist or must be some agitators of some kind. There were individuals, of course, who did raise their voices during this time. Mike and Judith Thornberry were Methodist missionaries who helped Peng Ming Min, who had been a legal scholar who was under house arrest, to help him escape in 1969 from Taiwan. Several of my Marino friends dared to be supportive of democracy activists. There was a priest named Father Bocchieri, who actually hit Chen Chu, who's now the mayor of Kaohsiung. When she was a political activist in 1977, the police were after her trying to catch her. He hit her in his church for three days, and of course got kicked out of the country eventually. He wasn't allowed back in. That was the polite way of doing it those days. So the great exception to this unwillingness to stand up to the KMT and to the regime was the Presbyterian Church, and we'll hear more, I'm sure, about that from our Presbyterian friends here. But the important thing about the Presbyterians was that they had, when they came, and they came before the Japanese period, and Japanese came to Taiwan in 1895, Presbyterians were already there. And they had made a conscious choice to indigenize, first of all, and to educate. So they were very good at getting local pastors to be people from the community who spoke the local dialect. That's supposed, now, I speak Holo Taiwanese, right? That was fine, except I was a Hataga, right? I was a foreigner. I wasn't part of that community. Whereas the Presbyterians had people from the community who spoke the local languages and who stuck very much to their Taiwanese-ness in the face of both Japanese oppression eventually and KMT suppression later. That was the most important thing, but the other important thing was they were very good at educating people. A lot of people who were Presbyterians went off thanks to their support, and a lot of the doctors in Taiwan, lawyers, and other educated people in Taiwan were from the Presbyterian community. And it's that group that eventually stood up during the martial law time to be against the martial law and the suppression that it brought in Taiwan. So those two, I think those are two ways of looking at what was going on. Most institutions stayed quiet. Presbyterians were a big exception to that. I think the Buddhist and the Taoist and the other religious communities also stayed pretty much to their temples and were not a factor in the support or the push against KMT rule.
Thanks so much, Mike. That was really helpful. So next we move to Dr. Shi. So you have written extensively from an anthropological perspective about the role of religion in Taiwanese society and politics. And in particular, you've looked at the use of religious symbols and language in environmental protests. And I think that's significant today because we're looking not only at the history of religion inspiring movements, democratic movements, but about the present. So I was wondering if you could share briefly about your work on the employment of the goddess Mazu in anti-nuclear power protests and why you think this was so effective.
Thank you, Anne. I will try to present the findings of my research as precise as I could. So please bear with me. Gongliao people has been struggling in campaigning against the forced nuclear power plant for 30 years. So revealing three stages. So from a political dependent and environmental movement to a decade of quiet, and finally to a religiously reliable environmental movement. Throughout the campaign, Gongliao protesters have more or less been empowered by their patron goddesses, Mazu, in Renhong Temple. So, like many protesters, Mazu's statue was tiled with the head banner demonstrating anti-nuclear power. And this statue was carried around by the Gongliao people in their various demonstrations. So known as the Banhe Mazu, anti-nuclear power goddesses Mazu. The first assembly to consolidate the Yanliao Anti-Nuclear Self-Defense Association was held after the Chernobyl accident in 1988 in the Mazu Temple. Before the assembly, Mazu was consulted through moon block definition, known as the Bua Bui, so casting Bui. So the first question was consulted is whether construction of the fourth plant would not be completed. Unfortunately, this did not receive an affirmative response. Then the question was to ask, if the fourth plant would be built, and this obtained three affirmative responses. So when this occurred, the association, the committee, were dumbfounded, but the designer was calm and experienced in this situation. So then the question was be rephrased to ask whether the fourth plant would come into operation to generate electricity. This did not receive an affirmative response. The question was finally put in a different way to ask whether the built plant will not be able to generate electricity. So this obtained three affirmative responses. At this first stage, Gongliao the people work closely with the major opposition political party DPP, so aiming to stop the construction of the fourth nuclear power plant. Mazu's prediction was not particularly relevant to their target, and so was not taken very seriously. In 2000, the DPP was elected into the presidential office, in part due to its environmental supporters. However, there was a dramatic U-turn. In October 2000, the DPP premier announced the Gongliao plant project had been abolished, even though the matter had not been put to vote in the Legislative Assembly as required by the Constitution. In January 2001, the cancellation was blocked by the Council of the Grand Justice, and the plant was finally put to vote. The result was 134 votes for continual construction versus 70 votes for abolition. It was unacceptable for Gongliao people that the DPP government blamed them for the waste of the $1 million of taxpayer money, and also for being responsible for the economic downturn. So local people in Gongliao feel that they had been betrayed by the DPP. Hardline and the elderly protester pass away one after another, while many others were suffering from depression for a decade. In 2011, in the wake of Fukushima, the nuclear disaster, and also in realizing that the plant has somehow been built, and once the safety test has been completed, so it could be optional. So Gongliao people began to recall the 1988 Mazu prediction. The fourth plant would eventually be built, but that it would never be operated to generate electricity. So the post-2011 recall of the 1988 prediction, a key by Hua Dian, soon spread among the plant technicians. Yeah, and who were becoming increasingly anxious that they would never be able to get the plant operational, since the ongoing test had one after another failed or revealed additional problems. So many technicians have begun to doubt their knowledge and ability to make the plant operational. If Mazu predict this outcome 24 years ago, Mazu undergone the benchia. So, yes, so answer your question. It is because of Goddess Mazu, the Ling efficacy, the spirit power, has become a resource to sustain their three stage, the struggle and the 30 years the protest. So the first nuclear power plant is currently mothballed.
That's really helpful. It's especially helpful just moving into the next question, looking at what attracts people to religious faith and what people find compelling and in order to stay within it. While you find that efficacy, Ling, is the primary driver with the devotion to Mazu and Gongliao, we have our next panelist, Dr. Tung, has looked at conversion processes, so looking at why people choose to affiliate with a religious group. Zhufeng, your dissertation looked at conversion processes from traditional Chinese religion to Presbyterian Christianity, and criticisms of religious involvement with democratic politics in Taiwan have worried that an overly political or establishment faith actually compromises the core of religion, spirituality. Do you think that, in your findings, has political engagement affected religious vitality or diminished its spiritual draw? Does political activism attract or deter converts? When you look at religious decline or growth in Taiwan by group, does this correlate with political activism at all?
Well, probably can just answer no. So does political activism attract or defer? Will not attract converts. That's it, no. I'm going to say more. I know it's not time for responding, but I do find interesting that Professor just mentioned about efficacy. I did find the same thing in my research result, but I will talk more on that. So for my dissertation, I focused, I did some interviews to the first generation Christians, so-called. They're the first ones who became Christians in their family. So in Taiwan, we call them first generation Christians. And I interviewed like about 70 to 80 people, and they are all from Buddhist or Taoist traditional background to make sure that there's no other people in their family who are Christians. And so I asked how their experiences and why they want to become Christian converts, listen to their stories. But also basically I call myself a good friend of PCD, myself a Presbyterian church member. So over these years I have gathered some of my observations on them I'm going to share with you. So for me, I think we, of course, we'll see if we can apply the observation on PCT conference to other religious groups, such as Taoism Buddhist group. But I mean, we have already seen one traditional religious group. See, we think it's sort of apply, I guess. So the converts that they tend to feel that PCT are less westernized compared to other Protestant groups in Taiwan. And I know Mr. Pong also mentioned that the language is a key point, that the PCT use Holo Way as a primary language in their sermon and services, while other Protestant groups, they use Mandarin Chinese, we call our Putonghua. So it does seem, it seem to be very attractive to the converts at that time, because we know there are two groups, the islanders and the mainlanders. The islanders are the ones who emigrated to Taiwan earlier. The mainlanders are the ones who follow national government and KMT to Taiwan after 1945 or so. So the PCT does did attract many of the islanders to become converts. So like I said, from the very beginning, I will conclude that Taiwanese people don't normally convert to a religion because of a similar political stance that a religious group may have or present. Some local PCT pastors, well, the situation is not really changing, but as far as I know, that they, although they agree with the PCT political stance and participation, they are reluctant to adopt any political indication in their sermons and encourage their members to attend any political affiliated activity. Actually, I believe it's becoming less and less now. I just talked to a pastor actually a few hours ago and asked her about, because we live in the States and then sometimes we travel back, but we didn't have an official conversation on that. I asked him if there's any published thing on that on the PCT newspaper, and he said no. So, but basically, from what he had told me, he's a local leader in Kaohsiung, and he said, like, around the age of 30 to 60 years old, the young generation pastors, they worried to lose the new members from church, because if they talk more on politics, they, it looks like it does get the chance that they lose them. So they are having less and less talks on top politics in the sermon. But those who are older, sorry, I don't want to use that, but senior, like more than 60 years old, the pastors, they're fine. They still talk about politics in the sermon. They don't mind. But the younger pastor, they kind of have pressure not to lose the members. So basically, my conclusion is that, like, people, in that dissertation I wrote that the newcomers, they tend to pay more attention to Christian teachings, and they wanted to see if there's any major differences happening to their life after they turn to Christianity, and if there were any miracles happen after they pray. I think it's almost the same in the Chinese churches in the States. So whether this religion can present something extraordinary or miraculous things, promises to them, become a key to their conversion. You can see from that previous presentation. So I would say PCT's political participation may attract these people to come and take a look at the church, but that doesn't mean that they'll become Christians because of that. I would assume it may be similar to some other groups, some other religious groups, like Tsuji. But Tsuji may be different. But I mean other Buddhist and Taoist folk religious groups, they don't really reveal their political preferences, especially the religious leaders, even if they have one. But yet they are able to convince these believers only to focus on the teachings. This is what we always heard from news. There are some religious program TV stations in Taiwan. You don't hear any of them talking about politics directly. They always talk about teachings, like do good things, eliminating your karma, collecting your merit, send more fish back to the river, lake. That's what actually still happened now. There's another interesting observation for me is that PCT keep attracting, well, like, they still attract some people who are interested in politics, but it's interesting, if you ask them if they want to convert to Christianity, they'll tell you, I'm the oldest son in the family, I need to carry on that, ancestor type of thing. If I become a Christian, who gets to carry on So I did have some converts who struggled to become a Christian because they have faced like a super big their parents are against it. Like, if you dare to become Christian, I'm going to cut the relationship with you, that we have several of them and they fought and between husband and wife is the same, like we have. So so when it comes to their personal religious choice, they seem to cling to their traditional beliefs. And like I said, the key thing is whether this religion has presents some kind of efficacy to them. So if their prayers got, like if their sickness, families have some like serious disease, cancers, if they get healed, then they will convert to that religion. I'm sorry to say that, but it seems like to be the case to me.
That's really helpful. It's also interesting because it's an interesting transition, provides an interesting transition because our final panelist that we'll hear from, I mean, then we'll do more questions, but obviously, but is actually an activist, political activist, and comes from also in the Presbyterian tradition, and teaches at a Presbyterian theological seminary. And so Hannah, Dr. Chen, you are both a scholar and an activist. So while we began with a history of religious engagement with democratic movements in Taiwan, it would help to hear about the contemporary political and religious landscape a bit and about your own involvement. So could you share a bit about the way that your religious beliefs and work have motivated your engagement with causes like opposing the death penalty, LGBTQ rights, the rights of people with disabilities, and gender equality? In these movements, is religious mobilization common or rare? Do you see people of faith working alongside you in these contexts? Which groups have been allies?
Well, thanks, the moderator. Yeah. First of all, I would like to apologize that because I haven't been able to study abroad. My English is not my mother tongue. I could not speak English very well. So you have to pardon me. Yeah. I would like to place myself in the context of the democratization of Taiwan. So I would like to start to talk about what happened to Taiwan within the past 2 decades. And then I will tell you a little bit of my story. So for the past 2 decades, Taiwan has been through a transition from a dictatorship to democracy. However, the awareness of human rights in the public is still at the beginning stage. So the NGOs in Taiwan began to push the government very hard to join the global society of human rights, signing and legislating the act of implementation of ICCPR, ICESC in 2009, CEDAW in 2011, CRC in 2015, and the CRPD in 2015. And we begin the expert review board to help us improve our implementation of those human rights conventions in Taiwan. So it seems to me that Taiwan has prepared himself well to become a society not only rooted by law, but also based on some basic values of democracy and human rights. And that is why the government of President Chen makes transitional justice the first priority of her political agenda. And this is an ongoing process which would not stop or be ended probably in the next decade or the next 2 decades. I myself actually is quite lucky to be able to join in this transitional era of Taiwan. I'm a new settler, the mainlander, some people would call. However, I'm taking part of PCT, the most provocative denomination in the eyes of so-called mainlander, came into Taiwan after World War II. Presbyterian Church in Taiwan has always been playing a prophetic role under the rule of martial law. In the years of white terror, people are not Christians, but they would read and submit their articles to Taiwan Church News. And I used to be an editor and a journalist in TCN, the Taiwan Church News, for 3 years, and it got me exposed to and equipped with contextual theology, struggling for justice within the with the marginalized people and the oppressed people. However, my personal engagement with democratic grassroots movements in Taiwan starts from the year of 2000. At that time, I wrote a theological thesis on the immorality of death penalty. Soon, this paper has been used as an introduction to a poll among Christians conducted by one local church e-media called Faith, Hope, and Love. And since it was the very same year of Jubilee, so the Catholic Cardinal Sen coincidentally went to see President Chen asking for the moratorium at least for 1 year. However, the then President Chen promised something more than Cardinal Sen could imagine, the total abolition of death penalty in the future. Since then, I have constantly contact with even co-worked with Taiwan Association for Human Rights, Amnesty International Taiwan, Judicial Reform Foundation, Taiwan Alliance to End the Death Penalty, and the newly formed institute called Taiwan Innocent Project. So in 2008, I started to set up my own studio advocating feminist contextual theology. And the first conference that I organized was on disability liberation theology. In 2009, I held another conference on restorative justice because the Ministry of Justice at that time tried to introduce restorative justice into the jurisprudence of criminal court. Eventually, it seems quite clear to me that all the diverse issues that I confront to converges on one point, that is how to build a more care and just society for all. So, due to the reinstallment of execution in 2010, even though I felt a little bit reluctant to get involved in social movement directly as an activist, I decided to step on my no returning back theological journey with friends of NGO, with the reporter of PNN, namely the PTS News Network. At that time, I interviewed seven religious outstanding leaders, including the famous Buddhist master Shi Zhaohui and the Catholic Cardinal Shen and the so-called the pastor or the president of Chiang Kai-shek and Zhang Jingguo, Zhou Lianhua, etc., in order to stop the series of execution taking place in the following years. Unfortunately, it failed it. From 2010 to 2015, I started to co-host conferences with NGOs on restorative justice in place of trying to make it in place of retributive justice. And we have invited experts and judges abroad to come, like the retired Judge David Carruthers from New Zealand and Professor Michael Perlins from New York Law School, in order to enhance the visibility and the awareness among the public. I also set up a related blogs, websites, or Facebooks discussing issues like death penalty, gender equity, and the emergency of the religious right. So if you do not mind, I would like to show you those websites. This one is about the Christianity and the death penalty. So, and this one is about the conference that we hosted in 2015. At that time, we invited Michael Perlins and David Carruthers to come. This one is about the religious right. As you know, that due to the influence of globalization, Taiwan has been influenced by the religious right group in USA quickly. So in 2015, we have a political party mainly consisted of Christians. We call it 信心希望联盟, Faith and Hope Alliance. Yeah, this is the first political party mainly of a certain religion, Christianity. So I feel that at that time I feel that the religious right is coming to Taiwan. So I set up this study group to try to make arguments against the religious right in Taiwan. And then, because in Taiwan's almost all the seminaries have no curriculum including queer theology, so I try to build the strong tie between Hong Kong queer academic studies and Taiwan seminaries. So this is the homepage that was set up for such kind of long-term alliance between Taiwan and Hong Kong. And before I came, this is the last homepage that I set up for the 40th anniversary of Human Rights Declaration issued by KMC in 1977. Yeah, in that conference, we discussed the issues like the religions and human rights, and the dictatorship history of Taiwan, and the PCT's roles in that period of time, and the transitional justice issues like that. Okay. And how many times I have? I still have?
No, you're good. You have 5 minutes for the first question.
Oh, okay.
But feel free to close out your thought.
I will stop here.
Okay. We'll return to you in a second. I was just going to say also earlier, Dr. Tsang, you had said that you had responses. It wasn't time for response yet, but you try at these panels here to have very interactive and responsive dialogue. So if at any point anybody has responses they want to make, feel free to jump in and respond. So Mike, I actually want to go back to you now as soon as I get this up here. Okay. I'm not very good at multitasking. Okay. So Mike, I wanted to return to you and just follow up on some conversations that we've had, but also on one of the sort of seminal works on religion and democracy in Taiwan by Zheng Tianguo talks about democratic theologies and democratic ecclesiologies, so what a religion believes and then how a religious group is organized institutionally. And he identifies those as the primary indicators of whether a faith community will actively engage with democratic movements, processes, and polities or not. So in other words, religion can facilitate democracy formation or hold it back. Do you think that this explains the difference between some communities that we've talked about, different attitudes toward democracy? I know you've said that you felt the Catholic Church was too reluctant to become involved in resistance movements. Or do you think this is an insufficient explanation?
Well, I think it's true that your theology ought to inform your institution, right? But I don't think it's always happened that way, unfortunately. Certainly in the Roman Catholic world. When I was in the seminary in the mid-60s, Vatican Council had happened under John the 22nd. It was a very exciting time for those of us that were studying in the seminary. Pope John said he opened the windows and let the Spirit in, and it was going to be a time of renewal and great things would happen. Revive this dormant institution. And as seminarians, we batted around thoughts like preferential option for the poor, social justice, speaking truth to power, all these fairly powerful statements. And actually, of course, later, not so much later, liberation theology took place in Latin America particularly, where theologians were articulating a pushback against the ruling classes which controlled so much of, certainly Latin America for sure, and with some of the people who were involved actually going so far as to justify force as a possibility of overturning these ruling classes. The institutional Roman Catholic Church, though, would have none of this. They wanted to protect the institution, much as I talked about before. And it's important to remember that the hierarchy in Taiwan at that time were people who came from China, having been kicked out of China when the Chinese communists took over. And they were very conservative, both politically as well as religiously. So they saw any of this kind of talk about liberation theology, talk about social justice, as a threat to them institutionally because the government was opposed to it. So after Pope John passed away, subsequent theologians and popes and brought together a very reactionary kind of response to this kind of theologizing. So the structure of the Roman Catholic Church, to my mind, has remained very feudal ever since. We used to have a little joke going on, which was, who is the Pope? The Pope is the servant of God. Okay. Who are the bishops? The bishops are the servants of the servant of God. Okay. Who are the priests? The priests are the servants of the servants of the servant of God. And who are the lay people? Poor people who have a lot of servant problems. And I think, unfortunately, I think this still holds true in the kind of structure of the Roman Catholic Church, very feudal structure, if you know the history of where it came from. And remember, Protestants were, first of all, protesters, right? That's where the Protestant word comes from. They protested, Martin Luther and people of his time, protested against the Roman Catholic Church as it existed then, which was very much in alliance with the kings and princes of the day. You could study for a long time about how a lot of people feel the growing bourgeoisie and urban centers created a context within which Protestantism grew, because it was in opposition to the kings and princes and the feudal structures. So I think you can see in the very structures of the way the church has developed that the theology should inform the institutions. It didn't in my mind, anyhow, in the Roman Catholic world. It did in the Protestant world in certain instances, and I think, again, to come back to our friends, the Presbyterians, you certainly see this. It's a protest against the entrenched feudal structures, protests against those kind of economies to a more capitalist, if you will, individualized approach to the world. It's a new paradigm that challenged the hierarchy that is the Roman Catholic Church and paved the way for a stronger commitment by individual Christians to action in the political arena. So yes, religion can facilitate democratic formation, I believe that, and I believe particularly the Presbyterians were a leading edge in Taiwan in that score. I would emphasize their intense effort to indigenize and educate. And you can see that in the way that so many people who were leaders in the opposition to martial law came out of the Presbyterian Church. Reverend Goh Tsun Ming, who was the head of the Presbyterian Church from 1970 to 89, was a leading figure in this opposition to martial law and actually was sent to jail for his political activities. He was in jail, sentenced to 7 years. He only served four, from 1980 to 84. A dynamic man who everybody should love. So individual Christians, no matter what their institution or how it interacts with political power, were willing to come forward and act on their values. But institutions as institutions had a hard time doing that, and I think to this day. You know, in the Protestant world, of course, Martin Luther King is a famous example of somebody who stood up against racism, against war, the war in Vietnam, against all these other social justice evils. On the other end of the spectrum within the Protestant world, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a theologian during the Second World War, a German Lutheran, who was opposed to Hitler and what Hitler was doing, and was actually part of an assassinate Hitler plot. Got caught for his action and was executed for it. The Roman Catholic world has its fair share of people who are willing to live on their values no matter what the institutional church said. Francis of Assisi comes to mind, somebody who was very much out of the box in terms of the time of his times. There were people like friends of mine who were opposed to the Vietnam War, Daniel Berrigan, and a whole group of people who operated against the war of that day. And at the other end of that spectrum, in Colombia, there was a priest named Camilo Torres, who was actually following liberation theology, joined the guerrilla forces to fight against the classes of the day. So these are kind of extreme cases in some ways, but it shows you that individuals took seriously their beliefs, whatever the institutional church did. In Taiwan, a good friend of mine was Matthew Wong, Ong Bu Chong, he decided it was important to develop and organize credit unions. That may not seem like much of an institutional push against martial law, but what his idea was is to get people together to control their own economy, their small economy, loan to each other so they don't have to borrow from loan sharks, and they begin to organize at that little level, and it gives them an opening wedge to organize against the powers that be. I didn't agree with Matthew at the time, but I realized later how smart he was and how far-seeing he was in terms of trying to get people to organize themselves, work together, and not be isolated individuals up against this martial law machine. So I guess that's a long answer to your question, but I believe institutional church should act on its belief. I think individuals, by and large, have acted very strongly, but in my mind, except for the Presbyterian Church, that wasn't true in Taiwan. Now, I can tell you, it seems to me that as things develop, Tzu-chi and other forms of Buddhism have become more active in the political arena. We can talk more about that later, I guess.
Thanks, Mike. And that was I thought that was a great answer. And in a quick follow-up, were you actually friends with the Berrigan brothers?
Yes, I knew them. Yes.
Wow. Okay.
I'm old enough to know.
Okay. So, Dr. Shi, this is something that you've looked at a lot, but in terms of the different kinds of influences on culture and heritage in Taiwan, and what that has meant for democracy. So many have suggested that, just in the literature on religion and democracy, that Taiwan's Chinese heritage actually has made a contribution to the peaceful coexistence of Taiwan's plurality of politically engaged religious groups. Yet in Taiwan's efforts to establish itself rightfully as an entity apart from the PRC, it has at times attempted to shed its Chinese characteristics. How significant do you see this Chinese heritage being to the way that religion and the state interact in Taiwan?
Thank you, Anna, your questions. So I will begin to give a definition of culture. I find interesting the definition from a book I found in your second-hand bookstore in D.C. So called Notes Toward the Definition of Culture. So, okay, it's defined, no culture has appeared or developed except together with a religion. So in other words, I mean the culture appeared to be the product of the religion, and the religion the product of the culture. So
that's Eliot, for those who are interested.
So indeed, Taiwan is of multicultural heritage. Actually, the site of the fourth nuclear power plant was the historical community of the indigenous Catalan people. And so under the ground contain the relics of Catalan culture. And also the Mazu in the Renhe Temple was actually co-founded by women, both of Catalan and of Han Chinese ancestries. So the cult of the goddess Mazu have its origin, from China, but was brought to Taiwan with the Han Chinese migrant from the mainland. So the question actually is about the Qu Zhongguo Hua, right? The DPP, the decinalizations. This is a form of resist to the authoritarian KMT the rules, and it's Zai Han Hua, re-sinicization policy, in the 1950s, since 1950s. So as regard the KMT, the Zai Han Hua re-sinicization, this was a form of a resistance to the colonial Japanese rule and the Japanese Japanization policy. So indeed, they are very, very political, right? So the KMT, the re-sinicization revived some elements of Chinese culture while undermining others. For instance, Chinese Mandarin became the national language. But in contrast, Taiwan the native and the local language, such as indigenous language, Holo and Hakka, were banned in the media and the school. So undoubtedly, this is the KMT, the version of a Chinese culture, right? So with their reinvention for their political interest. So the KMT, the Zaihanghua re-sinicization was a political campaign. And so does the DPP, the Qu Zhongguohua de-sinicization. From the perspective of culture, there is no such Qu that matters. So, 文化是没有Qu的. Okay? Taiwan requires, rather than get rid of many more different cultural elements, including Japanese and Chinese, to digest as sources in order to create Taiwan's own culture and to establish itself as an entity unto itself. Okay, use the Mazu the case. Though Mazu has her Chinese origin, however, the Fanghe Mazu, the anti-nuclear power of Mazu, is actually the product of Taiwan. So performed by and embodied in the social political struggle of Gongliao the people in democratic Taiwan, so which has never been seen in PRC.
Great, thank you. Dr. Tung, I noticed when I was looking at your the next question I had for you that you had already answered it in your first attempt. So I'm actually going to go to Hannah and then ask, then just throw out a couple of questions for everybody. But Hannah, I wanted to ask the last specific question to you. So I know we have we've heard a lot about the Presbyterian Church in Taiwan today, understandably playing such a pivotal role. So with regard specifically to the role of the PCT, how do you think that the church can maintain its prophetic role in our time, despite maybe its history, more recent history of having a close relationship with political parties? How do you see the PCT continuing to live out the legacy of the Human Rights Declaration of 1977 that you mentioned? And how can it build upon that legacy of elevating and investing in indigenous communities, working toward more robust liberation and decolonization? Essentially what I'm asking is, can an establishment church maintain a reformist spirit? And if so, how?
Okay. So as everybody already know that Taiwan is a society with multi-faiths, and compared to Buddhism and folk religions, Christianity is just a minority group consisting of only 5 to 7% of total population. So all the grassroots movements I engaged, I try to adopt an approach of interreligious dialogue to mobilize religious groups. And of course, I run into some problems with NGOs because of that. Some atheist friends and workers with other faiths always want to exclude religious talk from the discourse of public affairs and trying to relegate faith to the private sphere or individual choice. For them, public policies should be decided by public reasons only. And you should have nothing to do with particular religious traditions. And friends of mine fear that religions may cause more clashes or conflicts instead of consensus. However, since institutionalized religions like Christianity or Catholics are kinds of NGOs or sort of half official sectors, which they also want to appear to for financial causes or buying supports. I would like to insist on my stand of inter-religious dialogue approach to public issues. So especially after the same-sex marriage controversies, more and more my co-workers and friends realize that the validity and justification of universal human rights need not to exclude religions, but to know how to channel them into a more positive interact with others. And I think this not only may help religion transform into a more democratic ones, but also help them prevent them from being the religious right close-minded, aggressive, that kind. So I want to make an example of what happened in Taiwan this year to clarify my point of view. This year is of special significance for Christianity worldwide because it is the Reformation 500 years anniversary. However, for PCT, it is also the 40th year anniversary of Human Rights Declaration. Okay, calm down. So the week before I got here, I just host a conference. I already show you the Facebook. And in order to understand the historical meaning of the event, you need to place it in the process of democratization. And hence, you would not forget this year is also the 70 anniversary years after the 228 massacre and the 30-year anniversary of the lift of martial law. So I can say that PCT's protest against the former authoritative region of KMT sparked the hope of democratization and became the adorable icon of liberation in Taiwan. However, it seems that PCT has entered into the eclipsed phase of being a prophetic voice within a civil society full of diversity and multiple competing values. However, the layperson's movement called Theology on Sunday, you know that? I believe Philosophy on Friday has already their C groups in UK and also in USA. Yeah. So now in Taiwan, we have so-called Theology on Sunday. And the ongoing reformation of PCT movement are taking place among the younger generations, trying to revive the spirit of reformation of PCT. So voices warning of the alliance between PCT and the government of Tsai for the independence of Taiwan, as well as the theology of nationalism at the cost of justice, has been raised among church members. How many times I left?
Oh, I didn't start it this time, the timer. Let's say, just another minute.
Okay, yeah. So in PCT's confession in 1985, the PCT recognized publicly its calling from God to be an agency of peace and reconciliation. Hence, PCT has initiated the reconciliation sermon or worship of 228 events annually since the end of dictatorship. However, since the President Chai makes transitional justice her first priority, transitional justice now becomes a very hard issue among PCT. One of my friends, Dr. Zheng Qingbao, he is actually a Malaysian. He published his research on the past church histories in the martial law period, named Joseph and His Brothers. He consciously chose this title in order to show that in the martial law period of time, PCT has been betrayed by his church brothers, other denominations in Taiwan. And this book actually caused turbulence and hot disputes among PCT and other denominations. Some people would say that this book caused more harm among Christianity. And however, PCT would say that only the truth can really bring liberation and healing to the brotherhoods among Christian denominations. And at that time, meanwhile, you can see that although the President Tsai made an official apology to indigenous people in August last year, the indigenous people now are not quite happy about the administration of Tsai and started to protest every day in the Kadakoa Avenue for their own transitional justice and historical justice. So in the conference that I just showed you before I got here, we have a serious discussion with other experts as well as some pastors and theological professors in PCT to see if there is any possibility to form a committee of transitional justice within PCT to help PCT transform itself in order to be a better agency of transitional justice in Taiwan.
Wonderful, thank you. So I just have a couple of last questions for everybody, so anyone jump in, and then we're going to open it up to all of you. So first, I just wanted to ask just if anybody had thoughts on this. How do you think that religious involvement in Taiwanese politics has changed since democratization, and in what ways do you see continuity with pre-democratization activism?
Well, I wanted to raise one point, which is a friend of mine, Richard Madsen, wrote this book on democracy's dharma. And I think the big change, one big change, has been the engagement by Buddhist organizations like Zizhi and other Fogonsan and other Buddhist organizations and also Taoist organization, trying to figure out how to adapt, if you will, Buddhist orientation to this dynamic of democracy. And Madsen makes the case that in the West, we've depended upon what he calls secular liberalism to try to focus on rational self-interest of individual citizens is what makes up a body politic. And he's talking about where the Buddhists have tried particularly to, instead of focusing on enlightenment in the future, try to be a bodhisattva, work together in the community to build justice, to build faith and hope and love and all those good virtues. And this has been a really interesting, he argues, and I'm not in a position to discredit him, that's for sure, but he argues that that's been a very important development to keep Taiwanese democracy, which can be kind of chaotic, kind of on the rails by people being engaged with each other. Interesting argument.
Thanks, Mike. Anything, anyone else?
Okay. The 民间信仰, the local region, the symbol, I mean, such as like the Matu, I think has since the democratization be employed more and also applied often to the struggle in the local the campaigns. But it doesn't mean, I mean, religion has changed to be more political, but the society has changed to be more democratic. Since democracy has created more civic room, so people are now more encouraged, I mean, to use the kind of region symbols to demonstrate their fears and the dislike in public, like the Gongliao the people. So indeed, local religion has always been served as a source of empowerment in terms of generating a socially constructed notion of power. So in Gongliao the case, so kind of generating sustainable relationships between individual and communities, and also the ethnic and ethic, the insights in connecting the past, the present, and the future. So as such, I see the continuity of the local religion in empowering those powerless, the people in pre and also post-democratic Taiwan.
That's great, thank you. Before we open it up to everybody, I'm just going to ask, I'm going to skip my second to last question and ask my last one. And again, anyone is free to answer this. So what kinds of, obviously GTI is predominantly a policy focused organization. And so what kinds of lessons do you think can be drawn from the Taiwanese experience for policymaking with regard especially to religious freedom and religious tolerance or pluralism? Is Taiwan's active but peaceful religious landscape a desirable replicable model or a historical accident?
Again, my friend Richard Madsen would argue that this development within Buddhism in Taiwan is a great symbol of how transcendent values can be incarnated, if you will, and bring out the best in people, in believers, and instead of splitting people apart the way some religions have tended to in the past, those elements have tried to bring people together, whether you believe, quotes unquote, in Buddhism or not. The question is, are you part of this larger community? So I think that's the message that Taiwan has been able to incarnate in a way. It's an ongoing process and not complete. That's one answer, I think.
All right, so just a quick thing. I think because of this like general atmosphere of religious tolerance, you do see like a lot of different religious groups, they align together to present a particular political issue that they desire, that just like to speakers just mentioned. So I think this does encourage like more possibilities or like more strength to the society that they cooperate together regardless of the religious difference, which I probably don't see that a lot in the States.
That's a good closing line. Okay, so it's 1:15, so this is the time that we're able to open it up to questions from the audience. Stephanie, our fabulous intern, will come to you. Please state your name and any affiliation that you have and your question. Thanks. Vincent.
I have so many questions, but I'll just limit it.
How about try one?
I'll limit it to one. Vincent Wong, a grad student at Georgetown University. My question is about another religion that we're going to talk about today, Islam. Especially in recent years with increasing migrant workers in Taiwan, Islam has become a lot more prominent and a lot more visible. And I know every year around Ramadan, that's always a question of contention, especially around the Taipei Main Station, where a lot of people in Taiwan are very critical of the fact that, you know, a lot of migrant workers are gathering in at the Taipei Main Station. What is the role of, how do you all see the role of Islam in Taiwan society in the future, and what sort of ways are being utilized to create more civic space for relevant organizations?
Okay, can I jump in just quickly? Because I think Chen has something to say. So I would say like if you see from an individual level, like you see like migrant workers who work for a family, the families are, they treat migrant workers nicely, but they're quite ignorant. Like they for them, like a lot of them didn't know that they don't eat pork. They've been feeding them pork for a while, and then suddenly they're like, oh my gosh, I didn't know that they don't eat. So they, I feel like there was, there's a level of education that needs to be applied to these families who hire them. But on the government level, I feel like they are also like slowly they're getting to know their habits. I think in general, the society is open to see that we have more people coming from different religious backgrounds. It doesn't matter whether they are migrant workers or not, but
But the society in general needs to learn what the specific characteristics from this religion that they need to be aware of, so they won't have the same mistake happening again.
Did anyone else have a response, Mike?
Well, I think another element to what's going on is the DPP now has this southbound policy, which deals with Southeast Asia and other places as well. So there's going to be a lot more interaction with Muslim communities in Malaysia, et cetera, Indonesia, et cetera. So I think that's going to be a mutually reinforcing element where people will learn from each other, get to know some of what the reality, not just that they don't eat pork, but what their other practices are. And, you know, there are more signs, halal food stalls, prayer mugs, things that make it more accommodating. But I think it's much broader than that, an educational work. So hopefully, I think by this is gets back to what makes the basics of religion, right? Is it a expanding universe with people, when they believe in Islam, they see a larger world, or are they narrow? And I think that's going to be the determining factor.
Everybody expect me to say something. I would like to say that migrant workers' human rights has been the main concern of PCT for quite a long time. So PCT actually has a center to care for the workers' human rights, and we actually we will try to educate our congregations to be more open to, or more friendly to the migrant workers in our society. So yes, that's right. Some people would say that those migrant workers always gathers in parks or railway stations all the time, and it seems to us that they always laugh and, you know, making activities in public sphere, which we seldom do that in Taiwan society. So there might be some clashes of culture, but I think that both the PCT and Taiwan society has been more and more, you know, open to South Asia's migrant workers. We now even have festivals, especially for migrant workers, like Po Shui Jie. Do you know Po Shui Jie? The water festival. Yeah.
Sophie, Jen, or I can just give your names and affiliations.
I'm Sophie Jin, and I'm with the Congressional Executive Commission on China. And I am curious about the sort of changes in the sort of religious freedom landscape in mainland China, and how that has affected connections with Taiwanese religious groups, and how I know, for example, well, actually, I don't know. I've only heard, so I'm wondering if maybe you guys can fill out some of what I've only heard sketches of about, like, for example, Michael, you mentioned Guo Guanchan, which I have heard, like, has had some interaction with mainland, I think, the state-sanctioned Buddhist organizations. And so, yeah, but also just more broadly, also with, like, Christian organizations as well.
Well, I know that the Catholic world has a strange issue, right, where there are underground churches that aren't officially recognized that are growing and spread throughout, and then there's the official Catholic Church organization, which the CCP is willing to let happen, and there's this big problem because in the good feudal structure of the Roman Catholic Church, the Pope is supposed to be the one who designates bishops, right, and the CCP wants to be able to designate the bishops, so there's a struggle about who's in charge here, right? But I think they're trying to work that out. Whether that's good or bad, I leave the other people to judge. But I think it's my understanding, and maybe others can talk more about the Protestant world, Christian churches have grown, especially evangelicals in China, but they're under a lot of pressure, so I can't say much more than that at this point.
Dr. Shu, do you have, because I know the Matsu worship has been a lot of interaction across the strait.
Yeah. Okay, I think both are very interesting, the question, all very challenging. for Taiwan. I mean, to test if Taiwan is a really democratic country, can able to extend the regional freedom and the tolerance. I mean, to China and also to the Southeast Asia, the country, including the Islam. And I find something interesting. I mean, about the Falun Gong, right? I mean, Falun Gong have no freedom in China, but have a freedom in Taiwan. But last time when I visit Taipei, I mean, in the 101 building the area, I was confused. I suddenly saw a bunch of the people, they carry the Chinese five-star flag, and they shouting against the Falun Gong. So they don't have a kind of, they shout at them, they don't have a right, I mean, in Taiwan. So I asked the policeman, where these Chinese people came from? But the policeman say, oh, they actually are kind of the 外籍新娘. I mean, it's the kind of Chinese married to Taiwan, and so on. But actually, they kind of got the money from the PRC, the government, to do this counter protest. But I just find the Taiwanese policemen just be tolerant. Is that because Taiwan is a democracy? I mean, they have a right to report it against the Falun Gong. We can't do anything.
I just want to touch on the Christian evangelical system. So I know, like, a lot of Protestant churches, they are so happy. I mean, they are so eager to spread the gospel in China, except PCP. We all know that. I was just asking my friend and see what is the current situation. And he's like, you know, some of the local pastors, they don't mind, but I mean, they're willing to expose to other the churches in China, but they need to know, you know, what can they bring the flag and, you know, that, like, the presentation issue, I will call that, like, can they, what kind of name can they use when they do this interaction? So all these things seem to block the possibilities of them going there or even start the possibility. So I would say, like, it looks like the on the local level, you do see, like, these pastors, they would love to give it a try, but they're waiting to hear from the headquarters. In the future, there will be some possibility, but we don't know anything yet.
So the concerns that you're describing about what name you can use, or whether
yeah, like, because, yeah, because that's the main concern from TPCT. For example, they're not going to use ROC if they're going to have any interaction with them. They don't want to have any name under China. Because that's, you know, that's always the argument, I mean, the arguing part, the point. We don't want to be under the name of China, and, you know, that's kind of the whole problem.
I would like to say two things. Well, the first thing is about what happened in 101 buildings. Dr. Xu said was in the old region of KMT mayors. Yeah, well, after the new mayor elected,
Kuwenza,
yeah, this kind of situation has no more happened, yeah, because Kuwenza has made a very strict order to the police officers to stop that kind of attacks by China foreign bride, we call it. Yeah, to or other China tourists against Falun Gong there. Yeah, and the second thing that I would like to say that is actually CCA, the Council of Churches of Asia, actually tried to breach
churches in China and PCT several times. Yeah, not in public, but in some kind of mission consultation or informal meetings like that. Yeah, but there are some concerns that came out again and again, like whether PCT are allowed it to, you know, defend its own confession to protect, you know, PCT has made his own confession in 1986, proclaiming that homeland and human rights are given by God. And so PCT are called by God to guard the Taiwanese people's safety and freedom. Yeah, and so such kind of issue came out again and again, whether PCT can hold fast on its faith and do the evangelical mission in China. And in fact, I would like to say that I don't think China is a country with freedom of religion. Yeah, and in fact, I think they try to, you know, manipulate religions, use it as a means to, you know, control, political control. Yeah, so let us take Hong Kong as an example. Hong Kong has been returned back to China 20 years, right? And nowadays, Hong Kong Christian churches feel that they have been, you know, strengthened on their neck, yeah. Because China government tried to, you know, use financial support and all kind of means to control the Christianity in Hong Kong. So nowadays, more and more theological professors or pastors are, you know, tend to keep silence over certain kind of issues. Yeah. And it seems happened in Taiwan gradually. And the main channel of China to do such kind of manipulation is through the folk religion, or we call it the folk religions. Mazu is one of them.
Now, the United Front's activity is a key element of Chinese approach to Taiwan, and it has many, many variations. Some of that is this Unification Party, which was out there with PRC flags. There's other much more subtle ways in which it tries to influence. And I would say one of the things that the DPP is worried about, for example, is in the next election, whether the ability to use social media formats to hack into the electoral process is something that people are very worried about. It's a little bit different than our topic, but it's very much involved.
However, it does lead me to say, as I close this up, although unless I could take one more question. I know Dr. Tsai had one. Yeah. But do you want to grab? And then I'll make my transition, my brilliant transition.
I just couldn't pass up this opportunity to ask Dr. Shi and Hamlet, because your presentation, actually, all of your presentation is just fantastic. I learned so much. But I have a question for Dr. Shi. I grew up in rural Taiwan, where there's a lot of legends about Ma Zhu, goddess Ma Zhu. And she was a very protective goddess. She even protected legends. And that when the Americans, the B-29, bombed Taiwan, she had her apron and put it in the Taiwan Strait. So she was very protective of the Taiwanese. And my question for you is, was that because of the trust of the Taiwanese people on Ma Zhu, Goddess Ma Zhu, that in Gongyao they would ask even Ma Zhu to get involved with that anti-nuclear movement? That's one question. Two, the second question for Hannah. I was brought up a Buddhist, and in 1960, I converted. I was baptized by the pastor. You said you called her a so-called Zhou Lianhua. He's the pastor for Chiang Kai-shek and Jiang Jingguo.
Yeah.
And he impressed me as very, very, very authoritative and very conservative. Conservative in such a sense that I was Baptist. He insisted all of the baptism had to be submerged from the core, from the water. It was so cold. I never had a
sound like a Presbyterian.
Never had an opportunity to ask him about the political situation. I mean, whether he, as you know, a lot of the Chinese Protestants, they were for martial law. And in later years, my father knew, we work fiercely against martial law. So I wanted to ask you the question, when you interviewed him, Zhou Lianhua,
yeah,
what kind of a person he impresses to you?
So, okay, let's do just 1 minute each for each question, and then for Fang Long and then Hannah, and then we'll...
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Tsai, the question. Yeah, indeed, I mean, you are right. Because of the trust, I mean, had built with this patron goddess of Mazu, right? I mean, for the Gongliao people. So even, I mean, in 1988, they kind of bwa-bwe, I mean, they didn't get the answer they want, right? So, but they still carry on, I mean, this deity when they do any demonstrations. And even once they put this, they took this goddess Mazu, go through the police the line and go through the legislator, the Yuan, and all the way put the Mazu behind the chair. Men to monitor. I mean, they are kind of examining the budget for the fourth plant budget. But as that time, the meeting couldn't carry on, so they think the model is efficacious. So, yeah, but of course, after a few days, the KMT just quicker the pass another meeting and quicker pass the budget for the building the fourth nuclear power plant, but they say because Mazu wasn't there, so they really, really trust the Mazu. So even after they have been kind of be laid down, they become very powerless, because particularly as the first stage, they really kind of depend on, I mean, work closely with the DPP, but they feel be kind of deceived or even betrayed by the DPP and their political interest. So, but because and after they can acquired, but they still recall the 1988 Mazu the prediction, so they become the power, the hope for them. So until today, the Mazu is still efficacious because this the fourth nuclear power plant has built but couldn't get operation to generate electricity. Yeah, so I hope this plant could be turned into a museum.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, actually, I met Pastor Joe in person twice. The first time is in 2000 year. At that time, I was attending an international conference on the abolishment of death penalty, Pastor Joe was very kind to me. It seems he was known that kind of high-ranking style. You know what I mean? And, he's no arrogance to me. And and the second time I met him is because of the interview, the videotape that we would like to make to stop the executions. At that time, he was ill, seriously. And so I sent the photo taken in 2000 year to him, because his secretary
refused to let me get direct contact with him, because at that time the whole societies were against the abolishment of death penalty. They want revenge. We can hardly find religious leaders standing out to say something against death penalty. And so the secretary refused to, his secretary at that time refused to let him get involved in such kind of disturbance of death penalty issue. Well, so I sent the photo that took taken in 2000 year. And then I got a message from him that he would like to be interviewed by me and also by another reporter together. I was impressed a lot by him. Yeah, and when I used the phrase, the pastor of the president, to refer to him, I didn't mean to look down him, because actually he is a close friend to PCT. Many people don't understand that. At that time, during the dictatorship, he actually is one of the drafters of the Human Rights Declaration issued by PCT. Yeah. However, he at the last moment, he refused to name his name on it. Yeah, and because of the conservative atmosphere of his church. Yeah, and according to my friend, Dr. Jen, his historical survey about the dictatorship history of Taiwan, he said that Zhou Lianhua once was on the list of KMT's assassination. Yeah, the reason for Pastor Zhou kept alive is because many female believers of KMT tried to protect him from assassination.
Thank you. Well, on that very dramatic note, I will say, let's give a round of applause to our wonderful panel. Thank you all so much for coming. And I do just want to mention that the thing Mike was talking about regarding potential hacking of the election and the 2018 election will actually be covered in our upcoming Global Taiwan Brief that will come out tomorrow. So please do subscribe online, globaltaiwan.org, and hope to see you again soon. Thank you again.
Very good. Very good. Bye-bye.